You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. And just in case you haven't listened to the show before, we talk about all things law enforcement. We go into the briefing room where I tell you my view from the blue. And then we go into the interview room where we have a great guest waiting. So before we do that, though, I want to bring to your attention my organization, the Wounded Blue, the National Assistance and Support Organization for Injured and Disabled Law Enforcement Officers. I would like you to do something for me, and that is go to the website, thewoundedblue.org, and check it out. If you can afford to donate, please do. These men and women desperately need your help. And if you haven't seen our documentary film, The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed, I urge you to go to Amazon or iTunes and download it and watch it. Also, if you live in Las Vegas, this film is going to be previewed at the Silver State Film Festival at the Orleans Theater on September 8th of this year. I will be attending, as will many of my compatriots. If you get a chance, this is going to be on the big screen at the Orleans Hotel Casino, a screening for the film festival. So I'm really excited about that. So, once again, let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. You've heard me talk about one of the major issues facing law enforcement and also the communities in many of the larger cities that we are facing. That is activist prosecutors. People getting elected, usually with millions of dollars injected into their campaigns from George Soros, who don't have any desire to put people in jail. Their desires are just the opposite, to reduce the population of people who are prosecuted and reduce the population of the people in prison, not because of public safety issues, but because of their own political agendas. This is happening more frequently than any of us could have ever predicted. Now, one of these activist prosecutors was elected in the wake of the Ferguson nonsense. His name is Wesley Bell, and he came to power in the year or so ago when he was elected as district attorney of the St. Louis area. Now, when he got elected once again on the platform of a very progressive platform. I don't know why we use that word progressive, because it really is quite the opposite. In this particular case, Bell does not want to prosecute for many, many crimes, and he has not. But he also did something right after taking office that is now costing the taxpayers of the St. Louis area many thousands of dollars, thanks to his political platform and his own ambitions. When he took office, the first thing he did was fire three of his most experienced prosecutors. Why? Because they were involved in the Michael Brown case and did not bring charges against Darren Wilson, the police officer involved in the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson. So he Bell gets elected, and the first thing he did is not because these prosecutors did anything wrong, but because he didn't want them around anymore because of their politics. They didn't agree with his politics. So now each of them has filed suit against the St. Louis County. And surprise, surprise, every single one of them has prevailed in the litigation, thereby costing not only, well, in this particular case, the third prosecutor, forced out by Wesley Bell, gets $70,000 settlement with St. Louis County. This is just the latest. Now, that's a $70,000. So far, there's been hundreds of thousands of dollars paid out because Bell and his vindictiveness in not judging other prosecutors by their abilities, but by their politics, Now he's costing the taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, that's just for the settlement. That doesn't count how much it cost their lawyers to fight these cases. So you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars pissed away of the taxpayers' money by Wesley Bell. And this is the kind of individual who couldn't care less about the public safety. The only thing he cares about is the political correctness and progressive agendas of George Soros, who backed him, and this new movement of political social activism by many district attorneys and prosecutors. So that's great, taxpayers. You guys elected him, and now you're going to pay the taxes for it. Great job. Also, let's talk about what's happening in Baltimore. So the city of Baltimore Police Department is different than the Baltimore County Police Department. Two separate agencies. Well, there's a headline that just came out today. Department of Justice sues Baltimore County Police because black people fail hiring test at greater rate. Let me read a little bit more out of this. The U.S. Department of Justice said the Baltimore County Police hiring process was racially discriminating. The discrimination suit under the Civil Rights Act said Baltimore County Police have engaged in, quote, unintended employment discrimination for entry-level and police cadet positions by using hiring examinations that were not job-related and disproportionately excluded black applicants. So, there have been a number of different police tests used in Baltimore over the years. They keep on changing them because they keep on getting accused of the same thing. Now, I found, let me explain the way it usually happens for hiring in police agencies. Some agencies hire only their own, from their own jurisdictions. Some have no requirements, because if you have a residency requirement, say you're in Detroit, you live in Detroit, and the only, now I don't know if Detroit does this or not, but some cities, in their hiring requirements, you have to be a citizen of that particular jurisdiction. Now, why is that restrictive? Well, it's because it is more and more difficult to get qualified applicants to take the police job. We all know why. The pay in many places is very poor. The training is less than adequate. The social environment now is so anti-law enforcement that more and more people are turning away from the job. So if you limit your pool of possible candidates to just the people that live in your city, then you have severely depleted your number of qualified people. So what happens? Well, if they insist on that requirement, many of these law enforcement agencies simply diminish their hiring standards. Now, we can all see where that's going to lead, right? And it has on many, many occasions. Baltimore County, I don't think they have that issue. I think that they will hire from all over, but the Department of Justice is now saying, well, because you're not hiring enough black applicants, you must be doing something wrong. I like the way they term this: unintended employment discrimination. So now you don't even have to intend to do it. You can just get accused of this of civil rights violation for trying to hire the best applicants. So the other part of this is, when I was reading this, there was a number of references to the questions. So from 2009 to 2013, the exam consisted of 85 questions divided up into the categories: reading comprehension, vocabulary, spelling, grammar, and logical order sequencing. I don't understand how this can be discriminatory. It's the same for every single person. It boggles my mind, except for when I read some of the comments by the Department of Justice civil rights attorney, who is the one bringing this lawsuit. I have a couple issues, they're talking about it being relevant to the job. Well, you know, you have to have reading comprehension, you have to have English, you have to have grammar, you have to know how to write a report. If you don't have the basic skills to do it, how do you be an officer that has any ability to get your thoughts on paper? So that's why this is, I find this to be a strange lawsuit. And here's what the attorney, his name is Ol Zuski, says, quote, "A law enforcement agency should look like the community it serves. As I have said repeatedly since taking office, I am committed to increasing diversity in the county's police department." Okay, we are all trying to get diversity. But does that mean that you are going to lower your hiring practices because of it? This has been done on many, many occasions, all with results that are negative to the community. When you hire someone for the law enforcement job, don't you want the best applicant that you can? Why does race even enter into the equation? When these scores are tallied, the computer that tallies them has no idea whether the candidate is white or black or Asian or Mexican. They simply go by the answers. And you know, this is an ongoing issue. This has been going on since before I took my first police test, and that was in the 1970s. So there's never been a test that has withstood the test of time, so to speak. Instead, there are these constant lawsuits. One test gets approved, and then a couple years later, they say it is a violation again. So I really wish the Department of Justice would look at this issue, and if there has to be one uniform test that is designed for every police department in the country, that is deemed fair, that is deemed one that hits on all eight cylinders of an adequate test, and it does what it's supposed to do, then maybe it's time we, as a profession, say, you know what, this is the test we're all going to use. I, for one, believe in conformity of certain things, and that includes training, and that includes a hiring practice. Literally, you can go to one community and have a test that's different from the next community over, and the same thing goes as far as the quality of the training and also the methodology of how to choose an applicant. You know, very often it's a written test and there's a verbal, then it's a psychological exam. It is a practical exam. There's a lot that goes into it. And the more we chip away at these requirements, and doesn't the public deserve, and the citizenry deserve, the best applicant possible in order to give that officer a badge and a gun and the authority to that goes along with the job? I, for one, believe that is something that is not something to be altered because of politics. And I'm afraid that that's what we've been seeing for years and years and years. And I'm afraid I didn't think that under the Trump administration that these type of lawsuits against the police department would take place. But apparently the Department of Justice is once again looking at this topic and exerting its authority. Now, on a positive note, I just want to talk briefly about an incident that happened in Los Angeles County just several days ago. A deputy had been requested for an investigation into a suspicious person in a convenience store parking lot. When he got there, the individual who he was talking to attacked him. And not only attacked him, but was trying to get his gun out of the holster. So literally, when this happens, this is a fight for your life. And the deputy is trying to retain his weapon. The suspect is trying to pull it out. And three different citizens didn't know each other, saw that the officer was having this fight for his life. And instead of what we've been seeing in New York and several other places where people jeer and throw things at the police and attack the police, these three men went to his aid, and together they were able to subdue this individual. So I just want to say this to those three men in LA that decided that they were going to assist this deputy. I appreciate it, and so do all law enforcement officers in this country. When we see citizens doing the right thing and protecting their police, just as their police protect them, this is what America is all about. Well, we better run out of time, and we've got a great guest waiting for you in the interview room. So once again, please check out thewoundedblue.org and do what you can to support these men and women who have given so much to their communities. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that you need a deodorizer for, this stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. And register with them. Contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is Alan Cates. Alan is the author of a book called Cop Shock. This book is been in circulation for quite a while, but is just as germane now to the issues facing the American law enforcement officer as it has always been. Alan, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
So let's talk a little bit about what your background is, and what was it that brought you to be interested enough to literally spend years writing a book about law enforcement post-traumatic stress disorder?
I was, or I still am, a journalist throughout my entire adult life. I wrote magazine and newspaper stories, as well as television and film. I lived in Toronto for a while and became friends with police officers there and got real insight into what their life was like. And after I moved back to the U.S., because I was born in Chicago, I decided to write actually a newspaper story about police and PTSD and called the Los Angeles Police Department counseling unit. And I spoke to the head there because I wasn't even sure the police got PTSD. And he assured me, oh, yes, and do they do. And he invited me down. I interviewed a couple of police officers with PTSD. And that started things in motion. He is the one who talked me into writing a book, because I was going to write an article. His name is Detective William H. Martin. He's now retired. And I said, well, wouldn't you rather have like a psychologist or someone like that? He said, no, you're ideal because you have no axe to grind and you're just going to tell it the way it is. So I started work on the book. I thought I'd have it finished in 6 months, and it took me 6 years to research it and write it because the issues were so complex. You know, you read one psychological study, it says one thing. You read the next one, it says the opposite. So I had to read and absorb at least a dozen for every issue I was dealing with, whether it was suicidal thinking or the divorce rates for police officers, you know, and so on. I ended up interviewing over 200 police officers diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder across the country, and it really opened up my eyes to their suffering and how very few people knew about it, because police officers traditionally keep quiet. They don't like to talk about their feelings, but if you don't talk about them, then there's a good chance you're going to end up getting post-traumatic stress disorder. I know that sounds really simple to say, well, wait a minute, are you telling me that the cure, the answer for post-traumatic stress disorder is to talk about your feelings? And actually, yes, that's the beginning. And that will alleviate all the pressure because, you know, when you suppress feelings, one day they will come out. They don't go away. They will come out, and they'll come out in inappropriate ways. At times, you sure don't want them to come out. And so that is a beginning. And
So let me ask you this. When did the book get published?
The first edition was published in 1999, and the second edition was published in 2008.
Here's what really interests me. You were literally on the way ahead of your time. You know, this was a topic that is only now really being brought to the forefront for legitimate study and police dealing with this. So you were really kind of a groundbreaking author when it comes down to this topic.
You're right. I've been called a pioneer by a number of psychologists and police organizations. I had no idea that that's what I was doing at the time. I remember, you know, as I started to write the book, I thought, well, you know, I better check this out to see how many books are out there about this topic. There were not And I thought, well, maybe my research is flawed. And I kept looking and looking, and no, there were no books about the subject.
That I find that fascinating. So, you know, you're a journalist, and you got interested in this because you saw firsthand and heard firsthand from your own law enforcement friends how it was affecting them. So this became a passion of yours that literally has been, you know, for the rest of your life.
That is absolutely true. And I still remember, you know, when the third year mark came and my mother called me and she said, maybe it's time for you to give up this project. You know, mother, you know, they want you to get a real job, you know. And I explained to her, I said, you know, I have talked to so many police officers and they trust me and they want me to put their words into a book that's going to help other officers. And that was the criteria that these officers used. If I can help one other cop or one cop's family, then they are happy. And they told me stories that would just curl your hair about what happened after they developed post-traumatic stress disorder. After the book came out, my mother was very happy. And
well,
she actually said that I handed it to her. I visited her in Toronto and handed her the book, and she looked at it and she said, God bless you for this.
So, you know, this book has done really, really well. Do you have any idea how many books you've sold?
I'm only guessing because cops like to pass books around.
Sure.
But probably around 50,000.
And that's a ton of books. Books are considered, when I wrote my first book, I was shocked to learn that publishers, they feel that a book is successful if it sells 5,000 copies. So the fact that
I've heard exactly the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting. Now, so you wrote this book in 1999. Well, it came out in 99. You were researching it for 6 years before that. And so how has this journey been personally for you?
That's a very interesting question. After the book came out and it was an immediate success, I didn't feel good about it. And I kept wondering, what is the problem? And I knew what it was. And then I got a phone call that said everything. It was a police officer in New York who said, I was thinking of committing suicide. And then I read your book, and you saved my life. That was it, right there. That told me everything I needed to know, and it gave me the reason why I wrote the book.
Just hearing
from one police officer
right.
to say this, not only changed his life, it saved his life.
That is very gratifying. Well, now
it is.
This has become somewhat of a life's mission for you. You speak about this. Literally all over the country, right?
That is true. And that was one thing that I was not expecting. Immediately after the book came out, I started getting phone calls from police organizations, peer support organizations, and departments, you know, would you come and speak at our conference or would you give a seminar? And my first one was 20 minutes. The next one was a half an hour. Then it went to an hour. Then it went to 3.5 hours. And because I had done so much research, I had 6 boxes filled with research, and only 10% ended up in the book that is nearly 500 pages. After 9/11, a few weeks after, I was invited to New York to speak to peer support officers from the Port Authority and from the NYPD. Literally, I was met at the airplane by the director of this program, and she said, well, you cannot possibly talk to our officers until you go down to the site and get a sense of what we're talking about. So the next day, you know, I was wearing gloves, a mask, and a helmet, and goggles, and I went through the site, and it was horrific. Imagine if they didn't just clear a path by then and there were 2 stories of rubble on both sides of me as I went to this small group. And there was smoke and there was flames. And by the time I got to the end, I was in tears. And 2 police officers had me under each arm and they were dragging me out of there. And the director came up to him and she says, okay, now you get it. Now you can talk to our people.
That is, and, that's a good story, man.
Yeah. The next day, I was put into a university theater's, and you know, where they have the tiered chairs in all seats, and I was on a stage, and I spoke for 8 hours. I used visual aids, of course, but I gave the lecture of my life, and they recorded it, and they used it, and then I met literally hundreds of officers from the Port Authority who had lost most officers, and we talked about the stresses on them and how they're feeling and so on. It was just turned me right around. It was astounding.
You know, just for my listeners, that day when the World Trade Center was attacked has gone down in history as the deadliest day for law enforcement in history. 72 law enforcement officers lost their lives. And literally those reverberations are still being held, being felt today in very, very dramatic fashions. I think probably you're still being contacted by survivors of that terrible attack concerning their post-traumatic stress.
That is true. As you know, it's in the news because funding has to continue for the officers who worked on the pile so long. You know, I was in New York for about 4 days afterwards. And I'll tell you, when I came home, I was coughing and I was sick just from breathing in that air. Imagine one of the stories in the second edition of Cop Shock is about an officer who worked on the pile for 98 days. Imagine how sick he is.
Yeah.
And I was just there for a few days and I was sick.
This is a true injustice that the government, instead of understanding the devastation that this is still causing law enforcement and fire department people, instead of just saying, "Hey, here's the money," they're standing in the way. I can't for the life of me understand how they can piss away millions and millions and millions of dollars on useless programs that are just astoundingly stupid, and yet they're balking at funding something as important as this fund. That's going to drive you crazy.
It is. I was just reading about it today, and I'm reading it, and it's like, what do you mean you blocked it? How can you block it? You can't do that to these people who gave us everything. I mean, they gave us their lives, and now a lot of them are sick because they were breathing in that toxic air. I'm quite astounded because, as you said, the government spends money on the most frivolous things, the stupidest things. And here, when it comes to something really important where police officers are suffering years later and their families are suffering, and they say, oh, no, well, we can't give you the money. It's too much money. What? What do you mean it's too much money?
It's shocking to me. I guess I shouldn't be shocked about anything the way law enforcement officers are being treated today. So, in fact, let's speed up here to the present. I have, in my 34-year police career, never seen the disrespect and basically the culture of confrontation that is taking place today in many, many cities all over the United States. Do you think disrespect, this widespread disrespect, and what I call the culture of confrontation, is having a more and more detrimental effect on the mental health of our police?
Absolutely, I think it's having a terrible effect, and I just don't really get it because police officers are there for people. They believe absolutely they put their lives on the line every day for them. So to treat them with such disrespect, I don't understand it. You know, the police are not there on their own. They're being ordered to be in a certain place. and to help people and to be treated with the disrespect and animosity. These are our messengers. These are our people who are on the front line. I mean, without them, we have no society.
The media has played a really tremendous role in perpetuating myths about law enforcement. You know, a watershed moment, in my belief, was the Ferguson incident with the shooting of Michael Brown. The fiction of "Hands up, don't shoot" was actually, in my estimation, was one of the greatest perpetuations of lies that has ever been foisted on the American public. And even today, there are people that believe that Michael Brown was executed by Darren Wilson. And the reality is that Darren is the true victim here. That has to, I believe that that has had a tremendous effect on the mental health of cops all over the country. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. I think it's disgraceful what the media has done. I mean, they grab onto a story without thinking about the repercussions, about the effects it's going to have on society. Cops do such good work all the time. I mean, do you mean to tell me that a cop wakes up in the morning and says, "Oh, I got to go shoot somebody today"? I mean, that's crazy. They get up in the morning and say, "I'm going to go out and I'm going to help someone." That's how they think. Now, let me just tell you a quick personal story, and this just adds to my feeling about police officers. 3.5 years ago, my wife died suddenly, and that night, four cops stayed with me the entire night. It was not because I wrote a book. They didn't know anything about that, but they knew that I was in distress, and they stayed with me all night.
Wow.
I'll never forget that, ever. I'll never forget their kindness and how they looked after me.
That you just sent chills up my spine with that.
And you know what? That tells you everything you need to know about police officers.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So, you know, there are so many theories out there about the proper treatment, if you will, for post-traumatic stress. I call it injury. What is the term that you choose when you're referring to post-traumatic stress? It because it's not always a disorder. I consider it an injury. How do you characterize it?
Oh, you're right about that. As a matter of fact, the military has been trying to change the name to post-traumatic stress injury instead of disorder. Because a disorder suggests really something mentally wrong, which is not true. I mean, PTSD does not mean you're mentally ill. It means you have reacted to a very severe traumatic incident. And this is what happens to human beings. It doesn't matter how much training you have, and it is an injury. So the military has been trying to change the name so far without success. But I think that is the direction that we're going with PTSD, and eventually I think that the American Psychiatric Association, which puts out the book, basically the Bible about mental health, they will change it to that. But it is definitely an injury. It's like breaking your arm. If you break your arm, what do? Do you live with it? No. You get it fixed. You talk about it.
You know,
so that's how you have to treat PTSD.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this because of all the research and you're talking to officers all over the country. Many police officers are afraid to even go to their agencies and report that they are having issues, and for very good reasons in some places, because there are departments which will actually fire you or discipline you if you report that you are having issues. this is
something, you're right about that. Absolutely right.
To me, and, this is one of the issues that really truly needs to be addressed on a national basis.
Yeah, I agree. New York has tried to solve part of the problem. The Patrolmen's Benevolent Association created an organization that is now known as PAPA. Organization providing peer assistance. When police officers go to PAPA, they are not reported to the administration. They are sent to counselors, and this remains confidential for the most part, you know, unless the police officer, you know, wants to harm himself or harm somebody else. That's what needs to be done across the country. San Francisco has a similar type program where police officers get confidential counseling. But most often, America is made up of a lot of hundreds, if not thousands, of small departments. And these departments claim they don't have the resources to deal with officers with PTSD, and they don't provide peer assistance. Cops are left on their own. And if cops do complain, they do come and say, I've got PTSD, they get fired.
Exactly. And so what happens? They continue to suffer. The condition becomes exacerbated. And then what began as post-traumatic stress injury, does turn into post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, that's right. It gets worse, especially because cops feel betrayed. I mean, wouldn't you feel betrayed?
Absolutely.
And they feel betrayed, and that adds to their feelings of they're on their own, and they can't talk about it, and the post-traumatic stress disorder gets worse.
So are you familiar with the organization that we just launched, the Wounded Blue?
Yes, I am. I saw one of the films that the Wounded Blue put out, and I'm very much in support of the organization. It's a really important source and resource for police officers.
One of the things that I found, now I founded this organization because officers were coming to me on social media begging for help, but many because of physical injuries that they felt betrayed because they didn't get the proper medical care, they didn't get the financial care that they needed, and this in fact this is a question I've got for you that I believe is something that needs to be addressed on a national basis, and that is, I believe that the way officers are treated by their own administrations can actually lead to post-traumatic stress injury.
You know, when I was researching cop shock, I was thinking, you know, all the incidents they have on the street and the shootings, they lead to PTSD. What I was not expecting was that most of the studies that I read always pointed the finger at the administration and said they're the worst perpetrators of post-traumatic stress disorder because they don't support their police officers. They betray their police officers. They lie to them. And I know I'm going to get flack for saying that, but unfortunately, that's what happens. It's not all departments that do that.
Sure.
But too many do.
So let me ask you this. I when I do training seminars, I talk about this issue. And law enforcement leadership does not like to hear this. When you talk about this topic, how are you received by law enforcement leadership around the country?
Actually, I'm received very well, and it's because my approach is very different. I don't give these talks as someone with a vested interest, although I absolutely love police officers and their families, because I've got so much insight into who they are and what they do. So when I address leadership at some of these seminars, I just give them the facts. And they accept that. I give them the facts as the journalist. I said, do you really want to get rid of a police officer with PTSD after all the money you have spent on training? Do you know, Randy, that it can cost about $500,000 over a 5-year period to train one police officer? Do you want to throw that away? Isn't it better to to help that officer improve his or her quality of life, to get them the help that they need, and bring them back and make use of that astonishing training and their experience. You see, I don't get it. I don't understand why you would fire a police officer for a PTSD.
It boggles the mind, doesn't it? Here's another issue that even in, you know, when cops do go for assistance, when they believe that they need professional assistance, there are many states that do not recognize cumulative post-traumatic stress. They have it statutorily that it has to be related to one particular incident. What is that all about?
That is so far behind the times. And in Cop Truck, I have a whole chapter about cumulative traumatic experiences, like even low-level experiences that build up over time and lead to PTSD. This is very common. It's very well known. The American Psychiatric Association recognizes that, and yet police departments don't. They say, oh, no, it has to be one specific incident. Well, how about a dozen specific incidents? No, they don't buy that. It has to be one specific incident. So if a cop is going to make a PTSD claim, like a disability claim or something, they generally have to focus on one specific incident and say, this is the one that did it. What the officials don't understand is that sometimes it's just the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, it seems so minor, but it's a buildup over time of many, many incidents. And like, this was the last straw. In Cop Shock, I have a chapter actually about a man who worked on a police officer who worked on the pile, and he developed PTSD 5 years later, and it was a series of incidents. It wasn't just working on the pile. So 5 years later, he put his gun in his mouth, and then he realized, wait a minute, this was not the thing to do, and he went to Papa. He was a New York police officer. And he said, I was just about to kill myself and I need help. And they helped him. And now he's back working on the force.
You know, I know that NYPD is is actually heads and shoulders above many agencies because they have the resources and they have the ability and the desire. And yet, in 1 month, we saw 5 NYPD suicides in just 1 month. So what are we doing wrong? I mean, what can we do now to lower the suicide rate that has become an epidemic?
We have to remove the stigma of mental illness, which PTSD is not. And we have to help cops understand that they can turn to people for help, like Papa, like other peer support organizations. A peer support officer is a former police officer who's trained in dealing with these issues, such as suicidal thinking and so on. And, it's a real problem trying to break through a culture where police officers think that they're John Wayne and bullets bounce off their chests. And that usually only lasts for about a year. But they have, you know, an attitude, and they become cynical. And it's actually, I think, cynicism that starts to lead to all the problems. Cynicism because their departments don't support them. Cynicism because of how they're treated by people on the street. Cynicism because of how incidents are reported in the press without showing the wonderful things that police officers do.
You're right. You are absolutely right. And we're running out of time, Al. This discussion is fascinating. Where can people get the book Cop Shock?
They can go to the website for Cop Shock, which is www.copshock. So Cop Shock is one word. .com. And they can order it through the website, they can order it through Amazon, and they can also order it through different police organizations. All that is listed on the Cop Shock website. There's also a great deal of information on that website. Also about if you have to sue for disability because your department has denied it, There's a whole story about that and about a court case I participated in, which the police officer won. So with this happening more and more often, PTSD is recognized as a means to a disability pension.
Right.
As it should be.
As it should be. Exactly. So if somebody wants to book you to come speak to their organization, how do they find you?
They can find me through that website, or they can phone me directly at 520-616-7643. Or they can go to the Cop Shop website, and there's an email address that you can reach me at. So much information that would be very valuable to every police officer.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio. I can't thank you enough for the work that you are doing.
There's something very important I want you to do for me. If you've been listening to the Voice of American Law Enforcement for any time, you know that we are very dedicated to the law enforcement community here. I would like you to go to a website. It's www.thewoundedblue.org. I want you to read about how we at this organization are aiding injured and disabled law enforcement officers. If you are a law enforcement officer and you have been injured or disabled and you feel forgotten and alone, this is why we exist. We have a fully trained peer support team, all made of police officers who have been shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up, and screwed up. They know what you're going through, and we exist for you. You are the part of the Blue family, and you deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. Unfortunately, many police agencies and cities do not treat their officers with respect and dignity when they are injured, either physically or emotionally. So go to thewoundedblue.org. If you are a citizen and you want to help, please check out how you can join the Wounded Blue. And if you're a police officer or have been, exist for you. So check out thewoundedblue.org. Now, I would also urge you to see our film. It is on Amazon, it is on iTunes, it's the Microsoft Store, it's pretty much every platform you can imagine. It's called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. You would be shocked at how the men and women of this, you know, the law enforcement community in this country, many are being treated with such disrespect. Many people, most people, even cops, believe that if you are severely injured in the line of duty, you're going to be taken care of financially and emotionally. In many cases, that is not true. Please watch the film and help the Wounded Blue.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to the men and women of the profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty. This week, I have four names to read. The first is Deputy Sheriff Jose Luis Blancarte of the Kinney County Sheriff's Office in Texas. Deputy Sheriff Jose Blancarte suffered a fatal heart attack at the scene of a vehicle fire on Highway 90, 4 miles east of Brackettville. He began directing traffic after assisting at the fire scene. A short time later, he began feeling ill and requested EMS to his location. Medics began to perform CPR when he became unresponsive while being transported to a local hospital. He passed away shortly after arriving. Deputy Blancarte has served with the Kinney County Sheriffs for 20 years. He is survived by his wife and four children. Deputy Sheriff Jose Luis Blancarte, Kinney County Sheriff's Office, Texas. End of Watch, Friday, August 23rd, 2019. The second is Trooper Nicholas J. Hopkins of the Illinois State Police. Trooper Nicholas Hopkins was shot and killed while serving a search warrant at a home at 1426 North 42nd Street in East St. Louis, Illinois. He and other members of the emergency response team were making entry into the home at 5:30 a.m. when he was shot by an occupant during an exchange of gunfire. Trooper Hopkins has served with the Illinois State Police for 10 years. He is survived by his wife and children. Trooper Nicholas J. Hopkins, Illinois State Police. End of Watch, Friday, August 23rd, 2019. The third is Deputy Sheriff Carlos Kamen of the Orange County Sheriff's Office in California. Deputy Sheriff Carlos Kamen passed away on August 23, 2019, having never regained consciousness after collapsing during a SWAT training exercise on July 18, 2013. He was transported to a local hospital and treated for dehydration and cardiac issues after collapsing at the sheriff's training facility in Tustin, California. He was transferred to a rehabilitation center, but never regained consciousness before passing away in 2019. He had served with the Orange County Sheriff's Department for 6 years, was assigned to the Stanton Station. Deputy Sheriff Carlos Kamen, Orange County Sheriff's Department, California. End of watch, Friday, August 23rd, 2019. And the last is Trooper Moises Sanchez of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Texas Highway Patrol. Trooper Moises Sanchez succumbed to complications of gunshot wounds sustained on April 6, 2019 in McAllen, Texas. He had responded to a hit-and-run vehicle crash at the intersection of North 10th Street and West Freddy Gonzalez Drive. He located the suspect approximately one block away in the 1500 block of South Maltese Street and attempted to take him into custody. The subject shot him in the shoulder and head during the arrest. Trooper Sanchez was transported to a local hospital with serious injuries. He succumbed to complications of his wounds on August 24, 2019, following surgery. The man was arrested following a manhunt. He was charged with capital murder after Trooper Sanchez passed away. Trooper Sanchez is survived by his wife and three children. Trooper Moises Sanchez, Texas Department of Public Safety, Texas Highway Patrol. End of watch, Saturday, August 24th, 2019. Each of these men gave their lives in the line of duty, protecting the people of their communities. May they rest in peace. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I would urge for you to check me out on Facebook under the voice of American law enforcement. I do want to hear from you. If you have suggestions for the show, please contact me there and let me know. If you are a Twitterer, you can contact me at LT Randy Sutton. That's my Twitter account. And that's it for social media for me. Of course, that isn't true. I shouldn't say that. I guess I'm also on LinkedIn. And if you want to communicate over there, that works too. So thanks again. Make sure you check out thewoundedblue.org. And feel free to contact me if you have any suggestions or comments at my page, The Voice of American Law Enforcement, on Facebook.